Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Restoring the common good. I'm Gordon Deal with Nicole Murray. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Two politicians on opposite sides of the political aisle have launched a project to understand the state of American anxiety.
Would you try it? Some workers say ketamine and psychedelics can boost performance on the job.
It's getting harder to pass simple tests on a website to prove you're not a robot. Here are some examples.
And why there's a debate about who gets the armrest in the middle seat of an airplane.
If you are sitting in a row of three seats, the window person gets control of the shade, the aisle person gets the convenience of standing up whenever they feel like it, and the middle seat person gets access to both armrests. That's kind of the unwritten rule that I have always heard. And apparently, a majority of respondents to this survey disagree with that.
Zach Wichter at USA Today on why the middle seat should score the armrest. Well, policymakers in the U.S. are dealing with an electorate that is increasingly dissatisfied with their political leaders and their lives. A majority of Americans, including young Americans, believe the country to be headed in the wrong direction. Plus, national suicide rates are on the rise. Enter the Republican governor of Utah and a Democratic senator from the Northeast. Here's Morgan Chalfant, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief at Semaphore. Morgan, set this up.
Right. So Chris Murphy and Utah's Republican Governor Spencer Cox are joining together to start this initiative on, it's called Restoring the Common Good, but basically the idea is to try to look at why Americans are unsatisfied with their elected officials and with their lives, and kind of step back from the normal Washington infighting to try to get to the root of some of those problems and connect a little bit more with what people are feeling and, you know, in their families and in their communities. Interesting, for sure, pair. You know, it's interesting whenever we see a bipartisan initiative like this in an election year. Happiness and loneliness and social media and that impact on children are issues that Chris Murphy and Spencer Cox both have cared about and focused on in their official roles. So it does make sense, but always interesting to see a pair like this.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I think we'd probably all agree, and they might agree also, that some politicians are part of the root cause of the problem here.
Right. I think that's certainly part of it. I mean, it's very divisive politics that we're, you know, a divided electorate, divisive politics. And, you know, our leaders are, you know, getting in fights on Twitter or in person over, you know, kind of contentious policy issues and not really kind of paying attention to less politically divisive issues like happiness and how people are feeling. And so I think that's definitely a cause of it. And I think it's part of the challenge of an initiative like this, because yeah, you have to sort of remove that.
Right. All right. So Restoring the Common Good is the project. How will these guys measure success?
So Chris Murphy, who I spoke to about this a few days ago, said that basically they'll have failed if no one, it will have registered with no one, no one will have listened, and no one emulates it. So their goal is pretty simple. They just want to kind of start a conversation that other people pick up and continue. So the idea is to begin a thread about looking at things in a little bit of a different way and trying to connect with, you know, the questions like, you know, the questions about why people are unhappy and what makes a good life and basic kind of philosophical questions like that, start a conversation and try to have that rub off on other people.
We're speaking with Morgan Chalfant, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief at Semaphore. Her story is called A Bipartisan Pair Aims to Solve America's Happiness Problem. It's a reference to Senator Chris Murphy, the Democrat from Connecticut, getting together with Utah's Republican Governor Spencer Cox to create the Restoring the American Good Project. So how do they start these conversations? I mean, are they going to go to schools? Are going to, I don't know, hold news conferences? Like, what will they do?
Their plan is to go to have events in communities. So I think they're starting this Friday with an event in Salt Lake City. I don't know the particulars yet, but I think the goal is to meet with, you know, maybe local elected officials, local individuals there. Chris Murphy said they have plans for an event in Tennessee and perhaps one in Washington. They've also tapped a group of bipartisan policy experts, thinkers, to help them, a few people from AEI, some academics. So it's an initiative that also extends to sort of academia and some of the think tanks in DC.
And why these two particular politicians? You hinted at it earlier, but kind of peel those layers back.
So Chris Murphy has been focused for a while on, like I mentioned, loneliness and figuring out, you know, what makes people happy. Obviously, he's been a big voice in the gun violence and gun control debate. I think this sort of stems from that. And he actually told me that Senator Mitt Romney introduced him to Spencer Cox about a year ago, and the two have been talking for about a year about this. Spencer Cox obviously has been really focused in part on, you know, social media. They have a big social media law in Utah that's meant to sort of control children's access to it. And I think the way he thinks about that is mental health and families and sort of coming at it from that way. And it seems like Chris Murphy was drawn to him in part because of that work.
Yeah. I love the effort. I just feel like sometimes these ideas never gain traction.
Right, right. Well, and also the question of, you know, how do you measure success? Know, what does it translate to concretely? I think that's a really big challenge for them.
Thanks, Morgan. Morgan Chalfant, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief at Semaphore. Coming up next, performance-enhancing drugs at the office. Let me introduce the sports fans to Prize Picks. Prize Picks is America's number one fantasy sports app with over 3 million active members. It's the easiest and most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. On Prize Picks, it's just you against the numbers. All you do is pick more or less on 2-6 player stats and watch the winnings roll in. Here come the NBA and NHL playoffs, plus MLS soccer is underway, right? So maybe on a single entry, you choose LeBron James for more than 23 points, Connor McDavid for less than 3 assists, and Lionel Messi for more than 1 goal. You can now win up to 100 times your money. With as little as 4 correct picks, you can turn $10 into $1,000. Download the app today and use code DEAL for a first deposit match up to $100. That's code DEAL on PrizePicks for a deposit match up to $100. PrizePicks is really simple to play. I can make my picks and submit my entry in less than 60 seconds. Download the app and use code DEAL for a first deposit match up to $100. PrizePicks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. There's no magic pill for career success, right? But an increasingly vocal, if tiny, share of professionals swear a capsule of psilocybin or an infusion of ketamine comes pretty close. Business tripping, so to speak, by Callum Borchers, columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Cal, what have you found?
Well, what I found is that the ketamine in particular has become kind of a hack, if you will, for productivity and creativity for some small slice of white collar professionals. I don't want to say it's completely mainstream, but in certain corners of the business world, especially in tech, this has become a way to either overcome a mental health challenge when a doctor prescribes it off label, because the drug is only approved by the FDA for anesthesia, by the way, but it can produce a kind of psychedelic like side effect. And some professionals tell me it really helps spark creativity and get the juices flowing.
Jeez. All right, so maybe start with the basics here. Ketamine is what? You said used in anesthesia, but like, how's it work?
That's right. It is initially approved in the 70s by the FDA. It was kind of a Vietnam War era drug for battlefield anesthesia. But like many drugs, it has side effects, including causing people to dissociate. And so while it's not generally classified as a pure psychedelic in the way that, ecstasy or LSD are, it can have similar effects. But some users are not stopping there, by the way. You do see folks also dipping into so-called magic mushrooms, or psilocybin is the chemical name, especially for micro doses. So it's, we're a little bit cheeky with the headline about business tripping. And certainly some people are going on these psychedelic retreats where they really do have a pretty high dose and, have a pretty wide wild experience, we gather. But other professionals tell me that they're taking very small doses. We're talking 5-10% of what somebody might consume if they were partying, let's say. And so you get just a little bit of an effect. And what they claim is that it helps them quiet negative thoughts and maybe think more creatively about business problems. And there's, very limited academic research to support this, by the way, but a lot of folks are beginning to try this.
It's really something. So you mentioned the company Frontier Risk in your piece? I think they're in the insurance industry. Like, what's their experience here, or how did the ketamine work its way in here?
Yeah, Frontier Risk is an interesting case study. Relatively small company, about a dozen members on the team. And the chief executive, James Whitcomb, is somebody who says he turned to ketamine about 6 years ago, initially to treat depression, and he found that it worked well for him. And then he also found that it had the effect of helping him think more creatively about business problems. And he gave me an example. He said, you know, just recently I was at a ketamine clinic in Connecticut. This is above board, by the way. You can walk into a clinic in many states and go for a round of ketamine. And he said, you know, during a psychedelic experience on ketamine, I had the idea, what if as a team, we just got together on a video call with no agenda, no meeting, and we just sat there together and basically just watched each other work, sort of like a study hall might be. And of course, he comes out and he says, like, look, this sounds really hippy-dippy. I totally get it. Like, this is the kind of idea I would have dismissed if I was completely sober. He's a banking guy. He comes from Wall Street. Now he works in insurance. But he says, you know, in a slightly altered state of mind, I thought, yeah, it's worth a try. Let's try this. And the idea is maybe this will spark a serendipitous moment of collaboration on a team that's completely remote. They don't usually sit side by side. And so this is a way that he's trying to, you know, get the teamwork flowing. That may work or may not, but it's the kind of idea that professionals tell me that they have, that the running theme is people telling me that this stops them from second guessing themselves. It's not necessarily that the drug gives you an idea.
Wow.
It's that it sort of lowers your inhibitions, and the ideas that you might normally dismiss as that's a little out there, maybe you're willing to give it a go.
Wow. We're speaking with Callum Borchers. He writes the On the Clock column at the Wall Street Journal. This piece is called Business Tripping, the Professionals Trying Drugs to Get Better at Work. There was an issue where some trauma surfaced for a woman in a particular session here. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear. This is not a great experience for everybody. And I, you know, I spoke with someone who has administered ketamine during some of these, you know, rounds at a clinic. He said, you know, it can be a great experience for many people. But in this case, you know, this woman was really having a bad experience, you know, her on ketamine. For whatever reason, it triggered some trauma for her. And it's worth thinking about that happening in the context of a group outing with coworkers.
Thanks, Cal. Callum Borchers, columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, a better way to resolve differences.
Pure opportunity. It's what Michigan is all about. The opportunity to do more. The opportunity for all businesses to reach their full potential. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to discover all the ways the MEDC is helping Michigan thrive.
Hey, glad you're with us. Arrests have piled up and even commencement ceremonies are in jeopardy due to campus protests by pro-Palestinian demonstrators sparked by the war between Israel and Hamas. More about war from this weekend's Nicole Murray.
We are speaking with psychiatrist Judith Orloff. Judith, why is war the way humans try to solve differences?
Just throughout millennia, war is the way that they try and solve differences unsuccessfully. And the reason that I wrote The Genius of Empathy was to offer empathy as an option rather than going to war. And war never works. And war is a reason to be miserable. It's not a reason to be happy. It's a failure, as far as I'm concerned. And so with empathy, how empathy differs from war, war would be, you could war with yourself, you can war with others, you could war with the world, but warring isn't going to work. And if you have empathy, let's say you had a hard day on a very practical level, you have a hard day, instead of beating yourself up for being, you know, such an idiot and not doing what you should be doing, and I'm using those words carefully, you know, to put you down, you could say, you had a really difficult time, take a rest, it's all right. You know, so you don't go to war with yourself. People are always beating themselves up, okay? And then children see that, and others see that, and then the warring just perpetuates itself, you know, in terms of how you treat yourself, how you treat others, and then it translates into the world. But if children were to see parents, for instance, who are showing empathy to each other and saying, please tell me how I could understand you better versus, you know, why do you keep doing these stupid things, you know, and saying negative things, warring. So empathy is one solution to getting off the track of war and self-loathing and beating up your loved ones and making your loved ones your enemy and making other people in the world your enemy. I mean, that's where people go. If more energy was put into trying to understand each other, even if we radically disagree, which is the theme of the book, is how to have empathy with people you don't like or disagree with, but can reach a compromise with, it would be a very different world.
Let's say someone is leading with empathy, but the person on the other end of this is a bit more confrontational. How do you suggest they respond?
There's a method I talk about. It's called a gray rock method. And it's where you're like a gray rock. You're not emotionally reactive to that person. You're not feeding into them, or if they're narcissists who have empathy deficient disorder and can't respond empathically, you don't, quote, feed their supply. You're like a gray rock, and you hold yourself strong and firm and don't get emotionally triggered. And that will help avert an interpersonal war.
And knowing when to give up is also a factor here?
That is a big factor, because relationships are over way before people leave them. And so it gets to be battering, and they fight, and the children see the fighting, and it causes all kinds of damage, as opposed to a couple saying, let's start over. Now, if someone were to come to therapy with me, as you know, I'm a psychiatrist, you know, I would sit down and let's just map this out. What happened here? Where did you lose your love? Where did you turn your loved one into the enemy? Where did empathy get disregarded? And so I would work with the people on bringing empathy more in rather than shame, blame, putting the other person down, the needing to always be right. These are all themes I talk about in the book, and they're human. But if you want to have peace in your life, and towards yourself, how you speak to yourself is very important. And if you're going through, let's say, a physical challenge, you don't want to tell your body that it's healing too slowly or that it's not doing the right thing. The body has a consciousness, eyes and ears. You want to say nice things to it. So you build up your biochemistry and build up the endorphins and the dopamine, the pleasure hormones, so that you can heal more readily.
That's this weekend's Nicole Murray with psychiatrist Dr. Judith Orloff, author of a book called The Genius of Empathy. Coming up next, there's no debating who gets the airline armrest. Hey, it's Gordon Deal, and if you're tired of having the same thing over and over again every meal, do what I did and try Factor. Factor brings you chef-crafted gourmet meals ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from over 35 weekly menu options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Factor's ready-to-eat meals mean no prep and no mess, using the most premium ingredients like truffle butter and filet mignon. Customize your plans to fit your life. Pause or adjust deliveries anytime. And for April, you can celebrate Earth Day all month long. Just look for the badge to find your favorite low-carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/deal50 and use code DEAL50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code DEAL50 at factormeals.com/deal50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Factormeals.com/deal50 and use code DEAL50. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Nicole Murray. Coming up this half hour, the middle seat deserves a perk. Also, proving you're not a robot gets harder. And the on-demand poet in Philadelphia. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, apparently, airline etiquette is debatable and not the slam dunk many of us assume at 30,000 feet. Let's start with who gets the armrests, and then what are the other unwritten and unenforceable rules of air travel? Here's Zach Wichter, travel columnist at USA Today. Zach, what's up here?
So I was looking at some results from a survey that Kayak did last year. Kayak, that's the online travel booking platform. And I always just assumed that we as travelers were all on the same page about some really basic airplane etiquette. Like, if you are sitting in a row of three seats, the window person gets control of the shade, the aisle person gets the convenience of standing up whenever they feel like it, and the middle seat person gets access to both armrests. That's kind of the unwritten rule that I have always heard. And apparently, a majority of respondents to this survey disagree with that. They said that the middle seat people should not always get both middle armrests. I think that's crazy, and so I used the column to opine on that a little bit and some of these other basic ground rules that we can't all seem to agree on.
All right, so I agree 100% with those approaches.
Yeah.
But here's what I'm guessing is the argument these days opposed to that, and that's seat fees, right? I mean,
right.
I'm paying an extra, I don't know what it might be, $18 to sit like on the aisle or by the window, and therefore, since I'm paying more, I should be entitled to an armrest. Could that be part of it?
I think that is part of it. I think that, you know, some of the folks who I talked to, one guy who is, you know, opposed to our way of looking at things, this one person who I spoke to who doesn't think that the middle seat person should get both armrests, he did say, like, you need to be willing to pay up if you want to get your specific seating preference. And he also said, and I thought this was really interesting, that as seats get packed more tightly, he views the armrests now as a physical barrier and not an amenity. He was like, this is kind of the demarcation line between our seats. You shouldn't cross it. You shouldn't infringe on my space. And if you are crossing the armrest, then you have entered my personal bubble and I have the right to be annoyed at you.
Okay. So what I'm sensing here to a certain extent is when we combine the annoyance of fees with shrinking seats, the airlines have kind of brought this on themselves, perhaps some of our incivility or uncivility.
That seems to be a common thread with all airline complaints. People, you know, like to blame the airline for human indecency. And I think it's fair, like seats are definitely closer together than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. But I have to imagine that even in the golden age, people were still doing annoying things on planes.
We're speaking with Zach Wichter. He writes the cruising altitude column for USA Today. This piece is about airplane armrest etiquette. All right, so despite what the headline says, it's not just about the armrest here. There are other issues you tackled, like what? Unwritten rules of air travel.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the crazy thing that I kind of found in reporting this piece is everyone has their own rule book in their mind, and not everyone's rule book is the same. I think some of the things that we can all agree on are like, you know, you should try to economize with your carry-on baggage so that you maximize the overhead bin space for everyone else. I do think that there was a general consensus, maybe not about the armrests, but about like the window shade, being in control of the person sitting in the window and that kind of thing. But really, everyone kind of comes to this with their own opinions. And so it can be a little difficult to know what those unwritten rules are.
Thanks, Zach. Zach Wichter, travel columnist at USA Today. Coming up next, young student loan borrowers ask, where's my handout? As a business owner, you have necessary expenses, but some quick math might reveal that you're spending on items that are narrowing your profit margin. Get a smarter business plan with NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system. You have access to accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR all in one platform. With NetSuite, everything can be accessed in the cloud from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math and see how your company can benefit from NetSuite. Visit netsuite.com/Gordon. NetSuite has proven ways to cut costs and boost performance. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. netsuite.com/Gordon. That's netsuite.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. More than 40% of Gen Z swing state voters said in a December poll that President Biden wasn't doing enough to address student debt. Yet by one measure, he's forgiven $153 billion. A look at the disconnect from Jillian Berman, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Jillian, what's going on?
Yeah, so I think, you know, people who are concerned about student debt or who have it in their lives have been paying a lot of attention to headlines saying that President Joe Biden has canceled, you know, billions in student debt. But a lot of that cancellation is going to borrowers who've been paying for a long time. And so, you know, younger borrowers, borrowers in their 20s, even 30s, haven't really, you know, benefited from that.
Mm. So their reaction might be what? You spoke to at least a couple of them.
Yeah, so some are supportive of, you know, the fact that he's doing something about student debt, but they're still waiting to see if his plans will reach them. And, you know, young voters are a key demographic that the Biden administration is looking, or the Biden campaign, I should say, is looking to reach. And so, you know, whether or not they see this benefiting them could have some implications for the election.
Yeah, because as you say, Biden is underperforming with younger voters. Kind of peel those layers back a little bit.
Yeah, so he's underperforming with younger voters. There's a lot of reasons why that's the case. You know, younger voters have a lot of opinions on the war in Gaza right now. And then, you know, there's definitely some just, you know, more general economic anxiety. But, you know, student debt is an important issue for young voters. And so if he can convince them that he's, you know, that he's working for them on it, it could help to turn more out.
Yeah. I don't discount the fact that this is difficult for many young adults. In fact, you profiled this, I think she's a 27-year-old woman, Savannah Drake. She graduated from Arizona State. She's saddled with some debt, and she's sort of saying, what about us? But this has not really been about her.
Right. So the cancellation that the Biden administration has been able to actually push through so far is really geared towards people who have, you know, for lack of a better term, been, you know, been kind of screwed or harmed by the system that's already in place. You know, they've been paying for a long time. They've technically been eligible for debt forgiveness programs, but because of paperwork challenges, because of, you know, sort of servicer errors, they haven't actually receive that cancellation that they're eligible for under the law. And so Biden and his team, you know, went through and did a bunch of things that were really aimed at kind of like righting those wrongs. But it means that, you know, these are borrowers who have largely been in the system for a long time. And so not so much borrowers who recently graduated and are sort of coping with debt for the first time.
We're speaking with Jillian Berman, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. The story is called Biden has canceled $153 billion in student debt. Younger borrowers have not felt it. The woman from ASU, is she expecting it? I'm not here to bash her, but it almost seems like she's standing there with her hands out, like, or her hat out, like waiting for a gimme from the government.
Yeah, so it's hard to say that she's expecting it necessarily. I think part of the challenge is that Biden, when he campaigned in 2020, campaigned on a broad student debt cancellation program that it was unclear at the time, but probably would have impacted borrowers, younger borrowers, and, you know, kind of borrowers more widely. And the plan that he initially announced that got struck down by the Supreme Court last summer, that plan would have impacted borrowers sort of regardless of age. So, you know, some current college students would have benefited from that. Recent college grads would have benefited from that. So there was this kind of, you know, initial setup of, okay, young people, we're going to get a benefit from this. And then, you know, things changed a bit.
Yeah. How about, I think it was a UNLV student, Salvador Avila.
Yeah, so she, you know, she's supportive of President Biden, and she was happy to see that he's taken these steps to cancel student debt and sees it as, you know, sort of first steps to a broader solution, and, you know, is hoping that some of these efforts reach her. Biden announced a plan earlier this month that, you know, is still coming together, but would perhaps impact younger borrowers as well. So there's still some room for these borrowers to be included in his debt relief plans.
Thanks, Jillian. Jillian Berman, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Coming up next, the difficulty of proving you're not a robot.
What does the future of mobility in Michigan sound like? It's the sound of new EV charging stations at our state parks. Discover all the ways MEDC is driving next-gen mobility in Michigan at michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Hey, glad you're with us. For years, people trying to shop online or log into social media accounts might be pressed to complete bothersome but largely simple tasks. deciphering words in distorted type, or clicking on pictures of buses, bicycles, or traffic lights. Katie Dayton at the Wall Street Journal says now those tasks are getting odder, with security experts making them more difficult. Katie, the old ones are aging out, I guess?
Essentially, yes. So I think we're all very familiar with the click on all the boxes that have crosswalks in them or fire hydrants. And then before that, there were the ones where you had to unscramble the letters, you know, you had to like type in exactly what you saw. And I think, I always think it's like one of the last things that unites everyone in frustration about the internet. But yeah, bots have been able to be trained to crack them. Jeez. They're no longer an effective way of keeping bad actors out from websites. So the designers and the cybersecurity execs have come up with new versions of CAPTCHA, which is what it's called. And this kind of baffling everybody with these new tests.
I got a chuckle at one you included in your story. It was something along the lines of click the ones that cannot live underwater or something like that.
You're right. And it was just an array of pictures of various animals and some fish in there, too. So, yeah, they're just getting way more logic based. Like you, rather than just having to visually assess a situation and click on what you see, you now have to use your brain, your human brain, to understand the question that's being asked of you and make a judgment call from there. So, and you know what? One day a bot will be able to look at that question and dictate which animals can't live underwater. But right now, this is staying one step ahead of those bots.
Mm. We're speaking with Katie Dayton, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her story is called It's Not You. Those I Am Not a Robot tests are getting harder. I've seen the one now, like, slide the puzzle piece into place if I have to open a TikTok link. What else is out there right now that seems to be challenging at times?
Yeah, the slide the puzzle piece is, it's definitely, everyone's seen that on TikTok if you're logging in on a desktop or something like that. There is these ones that are going around where it's an animal and it's like be scattered with like a layer of texture across it, and you're asked to like click on the animal's nose or their bow tie, because you know one of the examples I saw was a raccoon wearing a bow tie. So again, you know, like, you know, in theory, very easy to do tasks that maybe would confuse a robot. But at the same time, they're very, very odd. And it's just very strange to see a kind of mind-bending, cheese dream-esque picture in front of you when you're just trying to log into a website.
I suspect at times the cybersecurity officials who make this stuff up have fun with it.
I think so. One of the companies I spoke to that designs these captures, you know, they hire like former video game developers, they hire artists, you know, I think they can be super broad in their own creative thinking. But they also have to make sure what they're designing isn't too hard. They have to test everything beforehand because they still need a pretty high success rate, even for the people that are logging in that they think are the dodgiest looking ones.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Dayton, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, Poetry on Demand in Philadelphia. Let me introduce the sports fans to Prize Picks. Prize Picks is America's number one fantasy sports app with over 3 million active members. It's the easiest and most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. On Prize Picks, it's just you against the numbers. All you do is pick more or less on 2-6 player stats and watch the winnings roll in. Here come the NBA and NHL playoffs, plus MLS soccer is underway, right? So maybe on a single entry, you choose LeBron James for more than 23 points, Connor McDavid for less than 3 assists, and Lionel Messi for more than 1 goal. You can now win up to 100 times your money. With as little as 4 correct picks, you can turn $10 into $1,000. Download the app today and use code DEAL for a first deposit match up to $100. That's code DEAL on PrizePicks for a deposit match up to $100. PrizePicks is really simple to play. I can make my picks and submit my entry in less than 60 seconds. Download the app and use code DEAL for a first deposit match up to $100. PrizePicks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy. Marshall James Cavanaugh, a self-described dream poet for hire, works at a makeshift desk typing on a battered but fully functional portable Smith Corona Skywriter, ready to spin whims into words. Influenced by beat poets who revolutionized the art in the 1950s and 60s, the 37-year-old busking bard sets up shop in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square and elsewhere so people can, as his sign says, pick a topic, get a poem. USA Today says Cavanaugh bikes from his West Philadelphia home Thursdays through Sundays, weather permitting. The typewriter packed in the suitcase it came with, purchased at an estate sale years ago. Cavanaugh usually writes free-form verse or haiku, and he sees the work as something belonging to the receiver, not the writer. Sometimes tourists ask for a poem as a souvenir of their time in the city. He'll see businessmen with flowers asking for a poem for their wives. And he's even had couples who got a poem while they were on a date ask him to write poetry at their wedding. That'll do it for this hour. For Nicole Murray, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.